Hi there, and welcome back to the Business Beyond Borders podcast with me, Cynthia Dearen. On this show, we unlock the secrets of international business success. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you'll know that in each episode, I talk to an entrepreneur who has expanded their business internationally about why they did it and how they got there. My guest today is Joanne Cooper, daughter of Australian IT pioneer Tom Cooper, who became famous for introducing the revolutionary Osborne portable computer into the Australian market in the early 1980s. Joanne has a really impressive CV, and over time she's become a pioneer in the tech space in her own right. Jo cut her entrepreneurial teeth during the PC revolution, and at the tender age of 18, she became managing director of her own company, Fox Computers, with distribution rights to something called Perfect Software. Joanne later merged her company with her father's company. Along the way, she worked with some of the really big names in the telecommunications space, including international players from countries like Taiwan and for the very large company, Optus. In 2015, Joanne established ID Exchange, which is an early stage startup that strives towards social privacy innovation and digital ethics. The company is a foundation member and resident at Sydney FinTech Incubator Stone and Chalk. Joanne, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's an honour to be on board.
Now, we're going to be talking about your company ID Exchange today and the fact that you develop privacy-enhancing technology. But before we get there, I wanted to start off with a question around something that's been a little bit topical over the last few weeks. And unless, listeners, you've been living under a rock, you will have noticed over the last few weeks that there's been quite some debate provoked around Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and the way that these two groups use people's data in order to pursue some particular agendas. And Joanne, I guess my point here is that, you know, this little episode that we've had has provoked quite some debate around the boundaries to people's right to privacy. As somebody who is working very closely in this space, it would be great to get your view on, you know, what this debate means and where those boundaries actually lie.
Well, thank you for that, Cynthia. I'm actually overjoyed about the controversy of storm that privacy has arisen over the last, 3-week period now, because I've been working in the area of developing privacy-enhancing technologies for near on 3 years now. And a lot of the conversation that I've had to battle is privacy is dead. We're never going to have our privacy back. The world is controlled by data and goodbye privacy. And I have, amongst many other professionals, said that's not the case. Privacy is a human right. Privacy is a freedom that has been fought by many wars and generations before us. And it's nothing that we can just wipe to the side and say, well, just because the evolution of the internet has become complex and because as an individual and as a consumer, I have traded my privacy, but really not had the transparency to understand the extent that I may have done that, that we don't have the right to use new regulation, new principles around privacy to bring that back into order. So the Facebook and Cambridge Analytica is just one story that we'll hear about. I'm sure there'll be many to follow, and that will just put a shift. It will put a paradigm shift into play, and it will put the industry on notice that the time is up, that these bad behaviours on how consumers' data is used and the ways that companies interface to get your personal information cannot continue, and we can move forward.
And so do you think in the short term we're going to see that drive significant change in the way that people share their data or in the way that they use platforms like Facebook?
Absolutely. In fact, ID Exchange, you know, in developing this level of technology, it's all consent-driven. And a year or so ago, I realised that to build a global and robust scale product that I needed to work with the best in field. So we looked for that internationally, and we found a company called Digiman, I'll maybe touch on them a bit later, that the founder had actually built the US military internet interoperability systems. So that's the level of tech that we're talking about in introducing to the consumer. And not only in the traditional method as we see things today, but in a consumer-centric view. This means it puts consumers back in control. You can say who has access to your information. When that access is no longer valid, you have the right to revoke that access and do it in a really simple and effective form.
That sounds pretty good. So I want to take a slightly different tack now. I want to kind of go back in time and just give people some context on who you are and where you've come from. So your dad is Tom Cooper, and lots of people might not know who Tom Cooper is, but what I can say is that Tom Cooper introduced the Osborne portable computer into the Australian market in the early 1980s. And as I understand it, that was quite revolutionary. So my question for you is, can you tell us a little bit about your dad and what growing up around somebody who was doing something very pioneering was?
Sure. So I suppose I won a life lottery ticket. I was born to parents that migrated from the UK to Australia and were about improving their life. And my father happened to go into the office equipment industry, and eventually that put him into his own business, where he saw the office equipment, the typewriter, that might be archaic to a few of your listeners, being replaced with a personal computer. So I was encouraged to join his company at a very early age of 15 out of school, which I was quite happy to do, I may say. And that put me at the forefront of the PC revolution. So I was, I suppose, had my very first mentor in life being my father, who was a captain of industry, who basically encouraged me that I could do anything that I put enough effort into doing. And I suppose it also put a mantra into the way I work, is that if you're going to go and do it, stop complaining. And if you're going to do it, go do it well. So from a very early age, I was inducted into the computer industry, and I've enjoyed that for the last 3 decades.
And you think there is a direct link there between your dad and working with office equipment and then computers, and the fact that you are now kind of deep in the land of fintech?
Well, I think he's passed the baton to me as an innovator, and, you know, he opened many factories and Australian industry initiatives in that industry. And, you know, I think that when you've been surrounded by technology mentors, I had the opportunity through him to open my first computer company at 18. At that time, I think I was the youngest female managing director in the sector, but that was for him was a model that he could test the Taiwanese computer market without upsetting his US distributors. And I kind of thought at the time, well, I'll let him use my name and set up a company. But he said, oh, no, Joe, you go run that company. And I can remember a couple of times being flabbergasted where I ran up and said, I've got this issue. And he said, well, how do you think you're going to resolve that issue? And I said, well, I think I should do this, this, this. And he said, absolutely, now go do it. And make me actually run the business. So, yes, it was a very lucky and fortuitous journey for me, and obviously that gave me training to do what I'm doing today.
So it sounds as though your dad was a really inspirational figure for you, you know, as you got started. Has there been anybody else who has, you know, who's inspired you as you've gone on the international journey that we're going to talk about today?
Absolutely. I mean, throughout my career, whether I've been in telecommunications or working with the Taiwanese manufacturers, there's always a standout. And I think that if you're passionate about what you do and you put in the extra effort to know and to learn, you'll always have access to those individuals. And throughout my career, I've always sought those people that are actually clear leaders. I suppose I knew how to identify that because I had that model in my father. And I always found out if I reached out and was persistent and structured in the way that I approached those individuals, that I always got their ear and their time.
Can you tell us about one or two of the ones that have really stuck in your mind?
So, you know, some of even the Taiwanese distributors, back when Taiwan was going through a really quite industrial burst in the Taiwanese computer market, sometimes the way they came about building technologies was, you talk about agile, it was super agile. And I can remember that I'd interface with some of the CEOs and I'd talk about some of the technologies, and they may give me a sample product and I might have to take that sample product to government. And I would debate that physically, or I could look at the product and it may not be quite right. And they would give me some of their cultural lessons in life, saying, Joanne, man is not perfect. Why do you expect this piece of device to be perfect? Go and explain it's not perfect, that it's a prototype and a sample. Talk to the merits of what that does and move forward. So, you know, there's lots of things. They're gems of information. They're a kaleidoscope through my life, and I've been very fortunate.
I love it. So we kind of touched on this very briefly just a second ago, but as you mentioned, you did quite a few different things before you started ID Exchange, which is where you are today. Can you tell me about that journey from, you know, setting up your first company at 18 and just kind of walk us through what happened that brought you to the point where you started ID Exchange?
Okay, so I suppose because I did 10 years in a family business and I was escalating to a lot of empowerment at a very early age, I probably took that into the career that followed that, whether it was in telco or an integrator or an insurance company. I kind of went in with that feeling that I could do and I had the right to do in those companies. So I found that I escalated in management very fast and often created successes that were landmark in those companies. ID Exchange, I suppose a lot of people in the last two decades kept saying to me, you know, you've got all these skills, why aren't you in your own business? But I also understood the commitment that your own business has. It's 24/7. But really, it was a catalyst event for me in forming the company. And really, that was to speak to the cyber war that is happening. We can't see, hear or touch that in our world. And I felt a responsibility as someone who had been in the industry and had a privileged journey that I feel that our sector has created a bit of environmental damage and that is it is incumbent amongst us as leaders in that industry to fix that within the data regime.
So you've just mentioned a cyber war. Can you explain for me a little bit about what you think that actually is, or what does that look like?
So the actual moment, that catalytic moment, I was watching actually an episode of 60 Minutes. It was back in 2015. The program was called Bug, Hacked and Tracked. And it basically showed if you own a mobile iPhone, a smartphone, and your phone, your device was on, your lights flashing, that if a hacker could infiltrate the SS7 vulnerabilities in the mobile network, they could record or film you at any given moment. And that's quite horrifying to a lot of people. And I watched that episode, and at the end of the episode, I actually was at my parents' property that day. I said, I need to do something about this. This is just not good enough. And I'd been thinking about some things and some ideas that I had, and I thought, well, we as the individual are the last mile of technology. It comes to us. We are the product now in data. Why aren't we controlling it? So I had an idea. I'd seen the Stone and Chalk Incubator being announced. I rang up within a few days, and in 2 weeks I'd pitched, I'd been accepted into the incubator, and the journey began.
And so when you went to pitch that incubator, what problems did you say you were going to solve, and on what scale?
Well, I said that we have world problems. I have a child that's going to inherit these problems, and she will have a child that, you know, won't have the luxury that I have. You know, the internet is in my lifetime. It's 40-odd years old now. It's a problem of my generation, and it needs to be fixed in my generation. So people like me, I don't have everything that I've done in my life, all my learnings, all my mistakes, recorded in data, but the children of today will. So we have to make sure that they're not manipulated, or identity politics comes into place, or people with disabilities are singled out. We have to make sure that we control those access points. And I just took a position that if I had IP and know how to lead that out, whatever I did was going to be impactful.
So on that note, you know, that was 3 years ago, you pitched, you started the business. What does ID Exchange do today? So, you know, for your customer, when they come to you, what is the problem that you solve for them, or that transformation that you create?
So we went on a journey basically to build something that most people might relate to, a do not call register, somewhere where you can shut down access to you, even though we have some issues in working effectively in our country at the moment. But so what we wanted to do is effectively give you a centralized do share or don't share register of your data, one place that you could really have an audit trail of, yes, I gave this company or this person access to this set of information under these terms and conditions, and basically enable legislation. So where they might not know how to evoke that notice or the right for de-identification, we would automate that process into a bit of a tick and flick. So we keep it nice and simple process for the consumer. And that's what we're focused on. So our products are built around the opt-out and opt-in instruments, which most people are told to opt-in or opt-out of, and that's what we bring together in a unified format.
And so if I came to you today and said, I wanted to use your product, how would I go about doing that?
Okay, so we're still in the development cycle. You mentioned before, you know, were you taking on a local problem or a global problem? We kind of decided that we were taking on a global problem from the get-go. In Australia, it's very difficult to raise funds when you're on the cutting edge of innovation and you're pre-revenue. So that slowed our journey quite a bit and was what led us into our international conversation. So right now, we've partnered with a UK company and we'll be looking to bed in their platform into Australia and then layer our technology onto their systems. And hopefully, I'd like to think by next year, if not this year, you'll start seeing some of our products become available.
So where can you just give me an example of where we might get it? I mean, is it will it be an app that people can download or will it be embedded in other people's platforms or how... You know, how will people actually access it in a practical sense?
So one of the things we're trying to do now is there's a new regulation coming out of Europe called the GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation. And that actually has mechanisms in it that you have to be consent-driven on your data access. So a lot of people are going to have to re-opt in, or if they're already become opted into something and change their mind, they'll have to opt out. So... we're taking a couple of paths. We've actually got some code in development right now at mass scale for some areas to have automated opt-in. And we're also looking to see how we can layer that into our partner DigiMe's platform as really a distribution model to if someone wants to opt into something, they can do a search. I need to opt in maybe for a NAP plan or opt out for NAP plan or travel or whatever the category might be. And they would come to our site, we'd give them informed information on how to activate that decision.
All right. So that's a little bit about, that gives us a bit of an understanding about what the company does. I'm interested to kind of dig in and understand now what it's like to be inside the business. And I want to talk about the international perspective. And maybe just before we get there, because you've kind of come through this startup journey pretty quickly. I'm interested to know, you know, as a startup business, we kind of touched on finance, and I'm thinking, you know, there might have been some other challenges. I'm interested to know what are the main challenges that you've faced so far? You know, what's been difficult?
I think one of the challenges is that it's not really a criticism. It's just, I think, something that I've observed. When you stand up and you say, look, you know, you're trying to take on a problem that the world doesn't know how to resolve, a lot of people give you a little bit of lip service and they'll have a conversation and they probably turn their back and go, yeah, right, good luck. and that's a natural reaction. And then you meet other people on the journey that are so succinctly have an alignment to that type of philosophy that want to get on board and do everything they can to help you. So I think, you know, for me as a leader in this area, I have to quickly delineate between, I suppose, you know, your detractors and your promoters mm-hmm. and those that can mm-hmm. assist you on that journey, and very much keeping the mindset that you can do. And yes, it is a big problem, but it's not a problem that's not surmountable.
And so what do you do when, you know, when you suspect that somebody is kind of telling you one thing to your face and something else when you're not around? I mean, what do you leave those people to the side and kind of continue on without them, or do you try and convince them of the merits of what you're doing, or how do you actually deal with that?
Depending on where they are in their industry or their thought process, sometimes I'll give a little bit of education so that we continue to educate. I may recall or try to recall that person so that I don't waste my time so much next time, because time is limited for me right now, so I'd rather try and invest my time where it's going to return to the cause, so to speak. But, you know, education is a big piece in it. You know, I've had the opportunity to present to the Productivity Commissioner. I've had recent opportunity to put input into the Treasury Review on Open Banking. And I have to say that, you know, the runway that I've been given is extraordinary. And in a lot of those conversations I have with government and regulators, they say, you know, there is a big behavioural change piece and an education piece that needs to take place. So I also myself have to take note of that and play my part in educating people along my way.
All right. Now, we also touched on very briefly before, and I'm interested to kind of dig in a bit to this kind of phrase that you brought up. We were saying off air before we started recording that the fintech industry has caused what you described as environmental damage. And I'm curious to hear a bit more about, you know, what does that environmental damage look like to you? Because obviously we're talking about cyberspace. So a lot of this, it's not like, you know, deforestation where you walk out and suddenly all the trees are dead. It's something else. So I'm interested to hear what that looks like for you, and also to know what you think the industry should be doing about that.
Okay. So you may have heard the expression, data is the new oil. Okay. So it's looking to be a commodity. I've read one research piece and it's valued that by 2020, the personal data market might be worth over a trillion euros in Europe, which is quite significant, right? So you can imagine there's going to be a big land grab take place for people wanting to get access to personal data and make money, traffic that data, use that data. So my question is, who owns that data? Who owns your identity? And I think that always must be the individual. When it comes to personal data, the individual should be the core owner of that as well. So we need to get that back in their hands. And at the moment, data has been screen scraped and obtained from a whole range of different areas. But is it accurate? Is it correct? Is it up to date? Is it malicious? Is it been intercepted with other data? So we might be acting on a lot of falsehoods, which this data economy is kind of swirling around us. So that's why I say, you know, we have an environmental damage. It's contaminated data in a lot of cases. And yet we're relying on the fourth industrial revolution being centered around data. So we've got to...
There's probably a question there as well about even, you know, whether that data should be out there in the first place, you know, even if it is accurate.
So the first thing we've got to do is get it back into the consumer's hands and get them back in control and sanitising whether that data is accurate or not, or if the use of that data is actually permissioned or not. Hmm. And, you know, if I have an energy supplier and I change energy suppliers, does that mean they have an endless trail to contact me or bombard me? Because I think, you know, we're getting a little bit of digital exhaustion taking place in our lives as well. So we just really need to have these new controls in place and new consumer-centric solutions. And when we start to tailor and to hone in our data, we can really start to make really meaningful impacts in our digital life.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about what ID Exchange is doing internationally. And you're sort of starting out in the international space, and where you started is a partnership with a UK company called DigiMe. Why the UK and why that particular company?
That's a great question. So in my early year in the privacy space, and I say that with the preface that I'd come out of technologies and data centres and, you know, big data systems. I would typically research 2 to 3 hours every day on the world market because we had blockchain technologies happening. We've got biometrics, you know, the identity business touches many, many different parts in the technology stack. And I wanted to make sure, A, there wasn't a competitor on the horizon, and if they were companies doing similar or parts of the tech stack, what was their evolutionary point to make sure that as I was developing tech, it wasn't in an immediate need of ideation itself. So I invested a lot of time to keep my eye and finger on the pulse of what was happening internationally. So I didn't particularly look for a partner in Europe. I looked for a partner in the global market. It just so happened that with the work that's been done in the European Union with the GDPR Act, which has been released in May, that Europe seemed to have an advantage on this subject matter. And I was fortunate, I went on a trade delegation with the Australian British Chamber of Commerce in this time, April last year. And during that trip, I had decided to touch 4 world leaders in technologies that I thought were complementary to mine. And they all happened to be based in Europe. So I met with those 4 CEOs, and one of the CEOs I met with was Julian Ranger from DigiMe. And although I got offered opportunities with all 4 companies, that was the one that resonated the most to me.
And so what was it that you looked for in that partner? I mean, when you kind of had these opportunities, I asked this question because I think when you are building an international venture or partnership, if you get the right one, can be a great way to, you know, to actually do that. A lot of people don't really know what they're going to require from that partner to make the partnership really great. What did you look for? What did you see in that company that was different to what you saw in the other ones?
It's probably one of the biggest problems that I had was to find the right partner. And the reason I say that is our technology being a switch, opting in and opting out, and we own hundreds of domains around the world to activate those opt-outs, means that we're a movement tool. And movements are forming all around the world. And as I touched on before, we've seen a lot of a storm in identity politics. So imagine if I've got a switching device that could be used to persuade people to move their services or their patronage from one company to another. It could have quite big impacts, and it might not be on a product. It could be in a political basis. So I spent a good part of my first year lobbying government, understanding what their policies and principles look like and what governance and maybe potential regulation we need to have in place. So if I had this technology, it wasn't in the hands of someone that became, you know, dare I say it, totalitarian, right? Mm. So what I was looking in the leadership sector was, A, someone who had the same shared philosophies to do social good and to build a platform that enriched people's lives for the future. That was the critical one for me. The second one is that they had a track record. You can't build a global scale system that is mission critical to individuals unless you can build it on a military grade. So Julian Ranger, having that military background, working on things like NATO standards, came with that in spades. And the last one was, I suppose, the opportunity to have shared capital interests with our intellectual property, so that if I merged my IP with their IP, it became the greater good of both parties. So those 3 were an absolute fit for me, and I actually say that it's probably one of the luckiest breaks I've had on my 3 years to actually have met Julian and to be lucky enough to become their partner.
And as you guys have worked together over, you know, the last couple of years, what do you think has been your key learning about creating a really great international partnership?
Keep doing. Keep the communication lines open. Have an open mind. Don't close the opportunities that you think that might not fit because they just may fit better than you think. And access. You know, one of the things that working with another global thought leader is that's all well and good, but if you can only talk to them once in a year, you know. But we've also been very delighted that the access to Julian's senior management team and his executives has been quite open and very giving.
And so looking forward, where do you see the partnership taking ID Exchange? I mean, what do you hope for in the long term from the partnership? So, you know, if you looked 5 years forward, where do you see that the partnership will have gone and what will it have generated for you and for DigiMe?
So I think we will amalgamate at some point. So obviously they're the bigger player in place at the moment, so we'll just see how that goes. But I would like to think that we land our IP that can be utilised on a world front. And if I can do that and I can create social goodness through leveraging and collaborating, I think we're on a winning streak.
That is a pretty spectacular vision to have. I like that.
Thank you.
I'd also like to know about what it's like to be a female entrepreneur in fintech. So, you know, there is a real range of views on this topic, but I'd like to know from your point of view, how have you found the experience of being a woman working in the fintech space? Has it been a plus? Has it been a minus? Has it been, you know, irrelevant? What's it like?
Well, the funny thing is, Cynthia, that coming out of telco and, you know, and I had worked for Allianz for 7 years prior and built a platform for them, I always thought tech was tech. I didn't realise that there was fintech and ag tech and med tech. I just thought tech was tech. But I suppose you do see in some genres there's maybe more male dominance at the top of the field than in others. So,
I'm kind of thinking Uber here, you know, because that's obviously one kind of end of the spectrum when it comes to the, you know, the male-female divide and how people feel about each other in that industry. But, you know, I'm interested in the rest of it as well.
Well, you know, through my life, and I think this goes right back to the beginning of my journey with my father, because, you know, I've got a brother who's a year older than me, and he was given absolutely the equal opportunities in life that I was. So I really didn't see any disparity of the opportunities he was given to me. So I didn't really ever acknowledge that there was a gender card to be played. I just thought, if I do my job and I do my job well, I will succeed. And it was as simple as that. So I suppose maybe in some way naively, I've always regarded myself a bit of a humanist rather than a feminist, or, you know, getting into the debate about it and being merit-based. Because I have to say that working in technology, I have been surrounded by the most amazing men that have mentored and supported me just as much as I've been around as many amazing women. And whether they play a role at the bottom of the spectrum or the top of the spectrum, they're all valid. And yeah, we all have our interests in life, and it's you know, again, it's that different interwoven fabric that makes all of us a success in life. So yeah, I try not to live by a framework that I should only do this or I should act in a certain way. I really focus on just trying to be me and just trying to be the best at being me.
And do you think people have, your perspective has obviously been, you know, that it doesn't really matter one way or the other, whether you're female or male. How have you found, as people approach you, have you found anybody who's been surprised by the fact that you're female and doing what you're doing, or have they just sort of accepted it and said, okay, well, Joanne's clearly good at her job, let's just do that?
I think if I've had any resistance, it might be because of age. You know, I'm in my 50s now. Mm-hmm. So they may look at me as this 50-year-old woman thinking, well, is she having a midlife crisis late or something and decided to kind of go on a world rampage. I really sometimes think, no, I've been doing this for 30-odd years and I've touched every layer of technology there is, and I think I've got my head on the right way. And, you know, you don't throw a lot of personal investment into a whim, and you don't take on an industry challenge as mighty as I have without, I would like to think, some planning and some thought process behind it. So if I kind of am taken the wrong way, I kind of chuckle about that. I think that's funny. Yeah. And I just move on.
I think that is interesting, though, because, you know, you mentioned this sort of aspect around age, but I wonder whether, you know, if a man turned up and he was 50 and he presented what you presented, whether that same question mark would pop up in people's minds. And I don't get to know the answer to that, but I do think that's an interesting kind of question to ponder.
Well, I mentioned I got to present to the Productivity Commission. I also was very fortunate. I had the opportunity to present at the NISTA Inquiry into Innovation and Research. Well, this is nearly 2 years ago now. And at the end of the hearing, and it was all about, you know, innovation and research and startup culture, one of the senators said, do you have any final comment to make? And I said, yes, I do. And it was about the very fact that I think that there is a absolute opportunity for the older age workforce that the government needs to kind of swing behind, because there's a deep lot of skills, and we're more focused on a millennial skill set that could actually be taken advantage of a lot of those grey hairs, whether they're male or female. I see a lot of my male counterparts also struggling post 50 to get, you know, reasonable roles back in the workforce, and it's just a shame.
Yeah, and look, I think that is a probably a more commonly acknowledged problem. So I think there's some general awareness out there that men who are older than 50 struggle if they find themselves at the end of a role to find a new role, and that's quite common. I haven't heard it discussed as much where women are concerned, but I mean, in my mind, that's an equally valid concern.
Correct.
Now, as you've been on this business journey, I'm sure there have been some times when things have gotten rough, because it's my experience that when you go into this entrepreneurial space, stuff comes up. So not every day is easy. I'm interested to know, you know, when you get to a place where you find yourself stuck and you don't know what to do, or you've got a really tough business decision in front of you, what kind of tools do you use to get yourself unstuck or to make the decisions? Or are there particular things that you do to kind of get your head back in the right space? How do you deal with that stuff as it comes up?
So I have an advisory committee in place, and at the moment, and that's an ex gratia advisory committee, which is a very good calling thing. If someone really is your supporter and they're going to help you, they don't necessarily have to get paid for it, whether you remunerate them down the track or they become a formal board member, so be it. But I basically have established an advisory committee, and that's male and female. And I have chosen people that represent different areas, whether it's health technologies, banking technologies, privacy professionals, digital communicators, so I can help get things that are complex simplified. So I've basically realised around me what are the different levels of professional services, and I've sought people that are absolute masters in their field. So if I get stuck on any particular aspect, I can give them a call, vent it out. We speak very frankly. It's very raw. They know me quite well, and they know I am a communicator. So there's no holds barred in those conversations. And I can put down that phone and know that I've got the honest opinion and an untainted view of what they really think.
And that must be extremely helpful.
It is, definitely.
Because that CEO or founder place can be pretty lonely. You know, that can be a very lonely journey when things get difficult and, you know, there isn't anybody else in the echo chamber with you.
It is. Another thing that I use as a self-discipline as well, I mentioned I went on the UK FinTech delegation with the British Chamber. When I was on that delegation, we were honoured to visit the Churchill War Rooms, and there was a leadership session that day. And then coincidentally, you know, it was Anzac Day, and I got to go to Westminster Abbey, and again, the Dean of the Abbey talked about the cyber war, and I stood at the tomb of the unknown warrior, and I thought, you know, I'm not in a trench. I haven't got a bullet in my stomach. You know, yes, I may be tired and stressed some days, but people lost their lives for these freedoms that I'm talking about with privacy and where we're moving to in a digital world. So I kind of reflect on that if I have a bad day and think, come on, my worst day would be their best day in the circumstances that they fought for our freedoms. And that's a very good alignment tool for me.
So, yeah, that's really all about being able to keep things in perspective, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I think that's a really helpful piece of advice. So those are kind of internal resources and then some external people that you've got who help you as you do this journey. What about books. Have you got any favourite books, whether they be fiction or non-fiction, that you found helpful, you know, as you've built ID Exchange? And what are they and why?
So I typically like, I have a very, I think, probably a complex mind. So I do read the net every night, right? So I make sure I'm current with world news. But sometimes I'll look for a specific book. The last book that I purchased was called The One Thing. Mm-hmm. And what that did was just to remind you that there'll be one thing on your journey that is very, very key to your success, and to remind you what the, I suppose, emotional and intelligence tools are to bring that laser focus back into effect and to keep you on your journey.
That is a great book. And who is the author?
I can't remember, but it's got a yes, yellow and black cover.
Yeah, so The One Thing. Yeah, if anybody wants to have a look at that, they should go and Google it. All right, so that's a good tip. Let's look ahead now. Do you want to tell me about some of the things that are coming up for ID Exchange, you know, and some of the things that you are planning for the near and the far future?
Well, in the near future, next month, we're opening our Innovation Campus, and that's really me trying to, again, I suppose, be a little bit of an exemplar in doing what I'm saying, getting things done. So we're building a facility in Northwest Sydney, which will have an open door type policy to as much as our capacity allows. We've just moved in around 25 desks, and that's to allow whether it's top of field like banks or fintechs or anybody that's got some technology piece that needs to collaborate with another company who wants to develop on the DigiMe platform or needs introduction to our opt-in and opt-out IP to come and work with a technical team to assist them to achieve their goals. Similarly, we will open the doors to STEM education, whether that be through high schools, local universities, or just local people in the community that have an idea, don't think they're ready for an incubator, or feel that they may not qualify for an incubator, but have an idea and want to come in and have a dabble. If we can accommodate them, they can come and have a desk and be part of a community environment with people trying to action their great ideas.
That's a pretty cool project.
On the longer term, you know, it's, I think, a two-year cycle that we'll go through to enforce this new paradigm shift into consumer centricity, and that will take most of my focus.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, you know, what's next for you, where do you see yourself 10 years from now?
Well, next for me is tomorrow, right? We've got such a core focus and such a J-curve ahead of us. It's really, I think, just keeping focused on the immediate. I've often said that, you know, I had my first business at 18 in the computer industry, and I got a lot of spotlight then. This is probably my last hurrah in the industry, but my wish is to leave an imprint, and a good imprint, and an imprint that will travel way past me. And if I can retire out of the industry in the next 10 years, which I think I'm due, I'd like to just know that I've contributed.
I love it. How can people get in touch with you if they would like to know more about what you're doing or maybe get involved in some way?
They can go to our website, which is www.idexchange.me, and we've got a contact us page. They can go to that and they can get in contact.
That's fantastic. Now, look, it has been super to have you on the show today, and I've really enjoyed, you know, hearing about the journey of ID Exchange, and there have been some real gems in there, just small things and thoughts that you've mentioned. Do you have any final thoughts for people? And because we're doing this interview with you as part of our Girls Going Global campaign, particularly for women who are in whatever field they're in, thinking about the international journey, do you have any final thoughts for them about, you know, what they should do or how they should approach it or whether they should do it?
I don't know if many of your listeners have heard about your gut brain. You know, often our mind is led by emotions and senses from our gut. So if your gut is telling you, I know my subject, I'm passionate about my subject, I know that I can do something that's different, that seeks to fill a gap in the market, give it a go. Mm. Give it a go. You know, I knocked on Stone & Chalk's door 3 years ago and did a pitch with a world of experience, but I didn't know that they were going to accept me. I didn't know that I'd be on stage 7 days later. And the journey that I've been through in the last 3 years deserves a book. But it starts with those first steps of giving it a go. So have self-belief. If you've got that gut instinct in you, act on it and write your own story.
Joanne, thanks. Thanks again. I can't wait to see where you go next. And look, I look forward to having you back on the show at some point in the future so we can talk about where ID Exchange has gone and what it's become.
Well, go global girls, and thank you, Cynthia. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Hey, everyone. If you're enjoying the Business Beyond Borders podcast and you're thinking about expanding your company internationally, you might want to check out the International Business Accelerator, which is something I created to help micro to medium-sized businesses to speed up and de-risk the process of internationalization. The International Business Accelerator, or as we like to call it, the IBA, is a program built on the three principles of skills and knowledge, mentoring and accountability, and community. I built it especially for founders and CEOs who want to take their business to the next level and are wondering where to start. The program is structured in a way that's simple to follow. It's digital, so you can take part from anywhere in the world. It's a lot of fun and our members love it. So if that's you, if you're thinking about going global, check it out at internationalbusinessaccelerator.com.